say a few things, and then we're going on by one through the ones that are on the plate. I don't know that much about the ones on the plate either, but we'll talk about them as we face them. We're going to make it with no trouble time-wise, but at 5 o'clock, we're going to have three young ladies singing to you who have apparently practiced for years together because their voices just go beautifully, and they do an excellent job. They're going to come in and sing some songs for us at 5 o'clock, and they want to be punctual. They want to do a little sound check about 5 minutes of 5 or something like that. So I'll be out of their way, and they'll be up here and doing that. So I'd just like to, for those of you who are not familiar with Honey, I would like to tell you a tiny bit about what goes on, because I thought that Brian was going to do this. But anyway, when those bees go out and collect the nectar and bring the nectar back that's going to be made into honey, the color of the honey and the flavor of the honey is due to the nectar, one, or nectars that are being blended together at the time. So if a honey is labeled with a particular floral source on it, one anticipates that that is the predominant floral source in the honey and not necessarily pure whatever. And we're going to hit one here today, which is different from some honeys because it's called orange blossom. And when you dip it and taste it, you'll actually get a little hint of citrus coming from it. But that's actually an exception because most honeys don't necessarily taste like the flower smells from which the nectars came. And also, if you have a honey like orange blossom that literally came right off the citrus trees, then that citrus flavor is quite strong and quite enjoyable. But that's a premium honey. So when these honeys are packaged and put onto the shelf by these big commercial companies, they tend to make blends so that they have some other things that they add to the citrus. Well, I brought one of the blending honeys this time because you won't find it on the shelf anywhere, and that's cotton. It is one of the largest commercial honey crops in the state of California. It's very mild in taste. It's very low in moisture. And it is a premium blending honey. But you never eat cotton honey. However, if you buy citrus on the shelf, chances are you're getting citrus and cotton blended together. Cotton kind of thinned it out, okay? The moisture contents of the honey are not all the same. And sometimes you'll see these beekeepers, when you hand them a jar of honey, the first thing they'll do is they'll tip it up, upside down. And they want to see how fast the bubble goes up. Okay? The eastern honeys that run around 18.5%, you turn it over, and the bubble just goes whoop. The honeys in California, particularly from the Central Valley, where it's hot and dry in the summer, you turn it over, and it's almost like glue. It barely goes up. We had 13.5% relative humidity or moisture content in those honeys. Okay. About the only chemistry that's happened in there is that when the bees go out and collect the nectar, it could be sucrose, which you heard Liz talk about, or it could be glucose, it could be fructose. It's generally kind of a blend. Sometimes there's not much sucrose, sometimes there's quite a bit. But anyway, as soon as the bees get it into their body, and before they even get a chance to do very much with it, start manipulating it, they have enzymes that break down sucrose into glucose and fructose. So basically, that's what you've got, are glucose and fructose in all these honeys. And yes, it is that the percentage is very, very, very similar to high fructose corn syrup. The other thing is, when the glucose gets a little bit high in there compared to the fructose, that's the honeys that tend to granulate quicker than others. And I'm sure that you've seen a jar of honey that isn't liquid anymore. It looks like things have started to grow in it. Well, they are growing in there, but they're sugar crystals. They're not microbes. In fact, most microbes can't handle growing in honey. So that's granulation, and it's on purpose. They get the honey, and they have to get the moisture content down. The California honeys are so thick that you can't even make one of these so-called honey spreads or creamed honey or whatever they want to call it. So you have to adjust the moisture a little bit, and then you can take the honey, heat it up, and get rid of all the crystals of sugar that are starting to grow in there on their own, and put a little bit of this seed in there after the honey cools down. And you try to cool it down quickly, because anytime you heat honey, it drives the flavor off. So it's never as good when after it's been heated than it was originally. But nonetheless, you cool it down a little bit so that you won't melt the granules, and you stir in some spun honey, creamed honey, that was the consistency you like, and then you hold it at about 50 degrees for a period of time. It'll set up like a brick. Warm it up just a hair, and it's nice and soft, and it's sort of like a thick peanut butter. And that way it doesn't run all over you. I mean, put a lot of the knife in the space, on the knife on the spoon or whatever, and it's a different way to deal with it. The Canadians eat almost all of their honey around the house as creamed honey. They don't eat liquid honey the way we do. But that's a matter of choice. That's the way they do that. So that's controlled granulation. If you have some honey and it's beginning to get cloudy, it's beginning to get these chunks of sugar that you can actually see in there and whatnot, take the cap off, put it in the microwave, and hit it on high for 30 seconds. Then check out what's going on. No longer than 30 seconds, because if it's really getting kind of hard in there, the top will boil off and make a big mess. So you don't want that to happen. Stir it up, put it back in, give it about 30 more seconds. Generally, now you've got honey that's pretty warm, and you stir it one more time, and if it still looks cloudy and you want to give it a third shot, that's fine. But at that point in time, when you take it out, you better watch out, because it's hot enough to actually hurt your fingers when you're pulling it out. But that'll just bring it right back to liquid, if that's what you're interested in. So we've covered the moisture content, we've covered the color and the flavor and the blending of honeys. And so then I'll tell you what I tried to do here. I went out and got 9 different sources of honey. And what I wanted to do was to basically set them in front of you in what you and I would call a color sort of a thing, where we had the lightest ones. I don't know how your container is. The little corners that have the kind of wedge cuts on them, the little bevels, that should be what you and I call the top of the plate as you're looking at the plate. So don't let it get upside down. Okay? They should be beveled at the top. And what they told me was that depending upon which side of the plate that you sit on, start at the top, outer row, go all the way down that row, and then come in toward the middle and go all the way down that row. So you have these little straw stirrers, coffee stirrer things here. If you want to save a little bit of plastic, you can dip one end into A and then dip the second end into B. If there's nobody else sitting at your table and you want to double dip into your honey over and over again in any one of these spots, that's your business, okay? But if you're sharing it with somebody, just dip once. It doesn't take very much honey to get the flavor. You know, we aren't trying to eat a bunch of honey here, we're just trying to taste the flavors. So I kind of tried to get them in a color thing where you would go from lighter to darker colored honeys. And as a generality, the lightest colored ones also have the mildest flavor. And then as they get darker, they tend to become, we'll just call it, more robust. Okay? And I've got a really, really robust one on there, Eastern Buckwheat. And we'll deal with that through the honey here. Now, some more honeys were brought in for me, and so there's some coming up that I would have put up near the front end because of their taste and because of their color and whatnot that are at the end of the thing. But so we'll start now with what you and I refer to as in your case, the upper left-hand corner, okay? And I purchased that as clover honey because clover honey is the normal honey that you'll find in the grocery markets from Subi and those places, and it's supposed to be the standard honey, but I tasted that one, it doesn't quite taste like clover honey to me. But anyway, clover is the typical honey, And the floral sources are clover, but generally speaking, it's not the clover that's in your lawn. You could get some from there, but there aren't that many of those little clover heads around. It's clover honey from yellow and white sweet clover that grow in the Midwest, and alfalfa. They all taste pretty much the same. So that's the first one, and we'll just go ahead and take a taste. But like I said, I didn't think of that as exactly being what sous vide sells me. And I still don't. To me, you'll see in a minute, to me clover honey has more of a beeswax taste to it, and that doesn't. It's not a bad honey, but it doesn't taste exactly like clover. Now, I told the beekeepers in the Bay Area, once in a while you come up with a honey that tastes like butterscotch. And so the person from Gilroy came and said, I think maybe I've got some of that butterscotch honey. Well, no, it's not. Okay, it's the second one we're going to taste. If they really have that butterscotch honey, you'd almost swear that you took your straw and dipped it into butterscotch pudding and ate it. That's how butterscotchy it gets, okay? I tasted the Gilroy honey and I thought, hey, you know what? I'll taste it again just to make sure. That one tastes, except it tastes a little strong and stays on your tongue longer, that tastes more like the clover honey with a little bit of beeswax in the back than did the clover, to me. Now the next one, number three going down the list there, I had planned to be the lightest colored and one of the mildest flavored honeys that you would ever get into, and that's fireweed. And fireweed is just that. It is a weed that generally shows up in profusion in the Pacific Northwest in particular, but in the northern states following a fire. And generally, in the state of Washington, they produce quite a bit of fireweed honey. And if you look at the chart, in the back of the room, there's a chart that came from the National Honey Board and showed you what the different colors of the honey are. And they've got fireweed on here that looks the way fireweed ought to look. It's almost like white or colorless, light-colored Cairo syrup that somebody took like a half a drop of milk and mixed it into the whole thing. There's just a little tinge of color in there, otherwise it would be clear. So I got a hold of, these honeys were donated to me by the beekeepers. So I got a hold of a beekeeper out in Washington and I said, hey, you know, you advertise fireweed. And he said, oh, this is a horrible year for fireweed. It didn't come in. I've got some honey that I made at those locations, but it's not really fireweed. It's got other stuff in it. It's probably got berries, blackberries, brambles. It's got some other stuff in it. So anyway, number three going down there is supposed to be fireweed. And fireweed has kind of a flowery taste, but a very, very, very mild one. So I'll see. But this was way too dark. Yeah, the fireweed floral isn't in there too much. Anyway, not bad. Okay, you want to try number four? Cotton? Nobody buys cotton honey on the market, in the shelf. See, practically no flavor. Very, very light colored. Excellent blending honey. But you're not going to find it to eat it straight. Now the fifth one here, California sage honey, is produced for the most part in the San Joaquin Valley and down into Southern California in the coastal mountain regions. And sage is kind of a broad term because in some places you can also get these, you know, little annual sage plants that are fairly short and they produce sage honey. Or if you're down where those guys are I'm talking about, there is sage brush that comes up. And they've got this black button sage and purple button sage and a bunch of those things. Besides tasting very good, sage honey tends, if it's fairly pure, to not granulate. And the other one I hear you're going to taste is Tupelo. That tends to not granulate too, and that's from a tree down in southeastern United States. So sage honey, you can put it in the jar and you can just leave it sitting for a long, long, long time. It just stays liquid and things are fine. See, anything else about sage? At one time, sage honey used to be a premium honey and they got more for it. Now it's just in the mix. So I don't think there's much more to say about that other than that, the beekeepers this year really, 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 really thought that they were going to get sage honey because of the rain. And then because of the really, 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 really peculiar weather, they didn't get sage. And in fact, they got practically no honey here in California this year. They had 50% crop if they're lucky, no matter what it was. Okay, California sage. This is a kind of a premium honey. Tastes like sage. Okay. Now the sixth one, which should be the bottom one on your left-hand side, on the outer edge of the plate as you're going down, that is orange blossom. And I haven't stuck my tongue into this one yet, so I don't know if it's really, really orange or if it's orange that somebody blended. It's not the strongest orange flavor or citrus flavor that I've had, but there's a little there. Making me think either the bees blended it or somebody blended it before it went into the jar and was called orange. I'll never know which. If you want to get some of these with their really straight flavors in them the way they ought to be, you go find the beekeepers. And they're at farmers markets sometimes, or you go right to the beekeeper's property and ask them. They normally have a few jars of something hanging around. Now, out here in California, we have quite a few species of eucalyptus, most of which bloom during the fall, winter, and early spring. So you will see beekeepers moving their hives out near these plantings of eucalyptus so that the bees can get in there and work on the eucalyptus. When the bees are out collecting the nectar and bringing it back and condensing it into honey, the inside of those hives smells like a eucalyptus menthol cough drop. It's really, really strong, okay? But, and I'll see about this, but generally what happens is when they get it all thickened up and capped and whatever, you don't sense too much of that. So I'll try that one. It's the top of the inner row now. Will you taste them all upside down? Okay, so there's definitely a taste there, but it's not menthol, it's not camphor, it's not eucalyptol. Okay. Okay, then we are now approaching the darker colored honeys, okay? And the second one, second one down on what would be your inner row, which is getting darker here, is Tupelo. And that's a famous honey from down in the southeastern part of the country, Georgia, places like that. Try to produce this. And I have to tell you something about honeys. If you're in a region where there's a particular type of honey being produced, that may become the one that you think is the best of all honeys, and that's the one that you want to eat and you're used to and whatnot, and Tupelo is one of those. It's a premium price, premium honey. So we'll taste it, and then you'll say, huh? Unless you come from down there, and then you'll say, yeah, this tastes pretty great. So that'll be a dark one. See, it's something you have to get used to. There's anything wrong with it. Probably be a very, very nice honey to bake into baked products like cookies and breads and that sort of thing. And speaking of using honey in those baked products, if you substitute honey for sugar, and generally you have to take just a little bit of the liquid, whatever the liquid was in the recipe, out, because honey is bringing liquid in with it, You'll get something when it first bakes, it comes out of the oven. If you eat it right then, it'll taste okay, but it'll be really kind of dry. But if it sits for a while, the fructose in the honey that's in it will absorb atmospheric moisture, and you will have a cake or a bread or whatever it is that won't dry out. It'll stay moist until you finish eating it. Okay, now I decided to put one in here, which in this my dish right here in front of me, it doesn't look too dark. Let's see. 7, 8, 9. Oh, I must have made you taste the wrong one somehow. That really dark one, that third one down there, is the Eastern buckwheat. Maybe that's what I just tasted. I wonder why it tasted a little bit off. Okay, let's try it again. 7 was the top one in the second row. Okay. Yeah, that was the eucalyptus. 8 was the tupelo. And then number 9, which is I think the darkest one, one of the darkest ones on the dish, that's the Eastern buckwheat. And my experience with Eastern buckwheat many times is, and I think we just tasted it out of order the wrong way, but anyway, my experience with that is that it looks like blackstrap molasses, and it just about tastes like blackstrap molasses. Now that's Eastern buckwheat. We have a California buckwheat out here, which is a wildflower that again is one of these shrubs, and that is very similar to sage. It's light colored, it's floral, it's very nice. This is Eastern buckwheat. Another thing, I don't know why you would want to eat, well, some people just pour it on the pancakes and they love it, but that's fine. You can do the same thing with molasses. So that's the third one down. I just got back from a Western Apicultural Society meeting in Hawaii. And they had a honey tasting there. 72 bottles of honey. That's how many the beekeepers brought to the meeting with them and set them out. No names, no identification, just numbers from 1 to 72. They gave you a score sheet, and you went around, you tasted each one, and you wrote whatever you wanted to write on your score sheet. The idea was to eventually come around to choosing the number one. If you haven't tasted some of these, more tropical honeys, they're different. Did any of you try the African honey that was in that little? Okay, that one was really different. Okay? But tropical honeys tend to be a little bit more on the different side, many of them, but not all of them. So I thought, well, okay, I've had tropical honeys before. They're not necessarily my favorite. There's nothing wrong with them, but it's not too much right with them, I thought. Nonetheless, I said, you know, if there's anything here that's produced by those bees that tastes like temperate climate honey, I'm probably going to rank that up at the top. So I went and tasted all 72 of them. It didn't take me long to knock it down to about 6. They were going to be amongst my final choice for favorites. And then I got down from 6 down to 3 without too much trouble either. And I had to go around those 3 a time or two more and finally chose the one. And yes, it tasted like a typical temperate climate honey, okay? But those last 2, man, I just couldn't tell which one I actually preferred over the other. So I called it a tie. It didn't really matter. They took a look at all the votes and whatnot. The one I voted on is number 1. Came in number 2 out of everybody. And it was a combination of lobua and 2 other plants I'd never heard of before in my life. But it sure tasted like, you know, temperate climate honey, why not? Then the second one was another mix of Hawaiian plants that were the same mix. So that's the reason, 2 different beekeepers in 2 different places, but the same plants. And that's why I couldn't differentiate between them. There wasn't any difference. Okay. So anyway, I didn't try these last 3 on the disc. They were brought out or in since. So we're now number 3 from the bottom on your inner row, and I'll see what their creamy lahua tastes like. I'll see if it's the one I chose to be the winner. It had this, but it had something else in it that mellowed it out just a little bit for the one that I chose for number 1. But this is similar. Okay. Which one? Here, it says here it is Hawaiian creamy. Yeah, creamy. It's granulated. Lahua, L-E-H-U-A, honey. They have very few letters in their alphabet out there. And so practically everything that they, every word that you can't pronounce because it's 5,000 letters long, you can write it though because they're phonetic. Okay, then if you don't want to be committal in your honey, you can call it wildflower, you can call it, you know, anything under the sun. Just don't put a name on it. So the next one that's coming up here is Southwest Desert Garden Honey. I have no idea what might be in there. But anyway, we'll give it a shot. That looks a little bit granulated as well. The reason that the ones you got earlier were not granulated is because I took them all home and shot them in the microwave. Tastes fine, but I can't tell you where it came from. There's mesquite out there in the desert. I don't know for sure what's going on. Okay, now the last one that's on there kind of interests me because when I first arrived in California in 1976, the biggest scourge that we had out in the plant world at that particular time was yellow star thistle. And it's a nasty plant. If you get into a thicket of that stuff, you can't walk through with your normal clothes on without getting all scratched to death and whatnot. But actually, worse than that is the fact that if horses eat the foliage, they can actually intoxicate themselves, not as in drunk. They'll poison themselves to the point that they die from consuming it. Okay, so there's a real good reason to not have it in pastures, and there was a real good reason to prevent it from taking over the universe, which it was tending to do. So the USDA kept introducing some insects that would bore into the head, some that would do this, some that would do that. They got a fly and a couple of moths, or a moth and a couple of flies, whatever. And they introduced them, and what would happen is these biocontrol agents would indeed it wouldn't completely eliminate the plants, but they knocked them way back. But it was kind of local. It didn't seem to be spreading anywhere. Well, like I said, that was in 1976. The biocontrol has spread now in many, many locations. So you can't find too many big stands of star thistle in California anymore. Star thistle is interesting because it puts down its roots when it first starts to rain, like now or shortly afterwards. And the little top of the plant doesn't do much of anything, but the root system grows down, 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 down all winter. While the soil is, and the moisture is coming down, the roots are going down with it. So they get way down in there where the moisture is going to be. And then later in the summer when it gets hot and everything else starts to be burning off, that's when the plant actually comes up. So normally around July or sometime, out comes those big heads on the top with the thistles sticking out of the sides of them, and a yellow flower, and the bees go to them. Well, at one time, the beekeepers in the Sacramento Valley, in the northern part of California, actually used to get enough of a crop that they had extracting equipment. They don't even own extracting equipment anymore. They got rid of it because they're just not getting a honey crop. And the reason is that the biocontrol has basically worked. It's when they work on those big heads up at the top, the nectar is basically knocked down to practically nothing. The plant then, though, the plant's hard to subdue. It puts little flowers out at the bottom. And so it still gets seed produced, but the beekeepers really don't get that much honey from it. Now, the one thing that I'll say for it is, if this is good yellow star thistle honey, it's, to me, the best tasting honey that I've ever eaten. It should have a really good floral bouquet. So I don't know. I didn't test this one. It's light enough. Can't change my mind. It's still one of the best tasting honeys I've ever tasted. I like that floral aspect. Okay, I didn't run around the table up in the other room where you people have been tasting honeys for voting purposes or whatever, or for the fun of it in there. Some of you can tell me then, of those honeys that you tasted back there, were some of them, besides that African one, really unique, or are they sort of all in the ballpark here?
No, unique.
Unique.
Medicinal.
Oh, and there's some that left an aftertaste. Yeah. Well, that's what I got, an aftertaste out of this clover. You don't get an aftertaste out of clover, so there's something wrong with this clover. Yeah. Yeah, you know, we have a honey tasting at picnic day every day out here on the campus. And the people will be going through the line. It's really, really interesting to see the opinions expressed by various people as they get the same thing of honey. One will say, oh, no, I don't want to eat that. And the next one will say, you know what, that's really good. So it really differs to your palate. Honey's not changing from person to person, but their perception of it is. And then one other Western Apicultural Society meeting, I'll never forget this. There was a fellow from Oregon who runs a honey company, or did at the time, and he brought some to taste. And he said, I have some buckwheat honey. And I said, well, is it Eastern buckwheat? You know that, yes, we grow that short buckwheat up here. I have some buckwheat honey. So I said, okay, I want to try it, because I know what the New York buckwheat tastes like. We've got some here. So I tasted it, and I said, what in the world is this really? And he said, it's buckwheat honey. And I said, you produce this on your bees from buckwheat? Yep. Why does it taste like goats?
Goats.
It tasted like goat. So you cannot necessarily predict what you're going to get from year to year, and I think that's part of the fun of dealing with your honey. If you've only got one hive out there, you're going to find that the honey that's coming in varies from plant source over the season. And there may be some unique times when the honey is very good, and other times when the honey is not so good. You won't even find in one of these tastings that I run any almond honey. And yet, over half of the colonies in the United States are on almonds in February and early March. And they are bringing nectar in, and sometimes they do thicken it up into honey. But it is so bitter that you wouldn't eat it. So we just leave it with the bees. And they eat it later on into the season when they're running short on food. That's cute. Yeah, if you want to get way off track, that reminds me of something. I took my granddaughter to Sacramento, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, anyway. And we went to Fairytale Land. I don't know if you've ever been to that place, but you have to duck to come in. They did that on purpose, you know, it's for little kids, but they let me in to pay. So anyway, we got inside, and there was this, what appeared to be a chicken going along, okay? So I said to my granddaughter, Amber, hey, Amber, let's go see if we can get near the chicken. Well, the chicken wasn't too scary, so we got real close to it, you know. We didn't have anything to feed it. If you stuck your hand out, it'd come right over and take it if they had something to give it. Okay, so then we kind of went around the corner, and here were some other hens. I mean, they really looked like hens, the more normal ones. That little thing was white, small, whatever. It just got around the corner. And that little white, small thing went, oh, 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 oh! Yeah, right, that was a rooster. Well, Amber, I'm sorry about that. Because she does know what a rooster is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Anyway, that reminded me. Okay, have you got questions about honey? Anything that would relate to honey? Because I'm supposed to do a question and answer thing. I'm not going to do that for too long. But do you have questions on honey? Then if you don't, you have questions on bees. And if you don't, we're done for the night. We want to get done in the night. We've got 15 or 20 minutes. Yeah.
So I'm curious as to what your theory is as to why the state had such poor honey production.
Okay, so the question is, the average honey production in the state of California generally is 60 pounds a colony. Now, since the people in Northern California don't produce any to speak of, okay, it must be the San Joaquin Valley and the Southern California people that do it. The San Joaquin Valley get about that average, and the people in Southern California get enough more to make up for the people up north that don't get any. So that's the way it normally works. It normally works pretty well when the weather is pretty close to normal, and we get rain. So we got rain this year. That wasn't the problem. But the weather was not close to normal. So it was cool, and it was rainy, and it was weird in the springtime, you know. And they just kind of shot right through some of the early flows without getting anything. And then I don't know what happened, but the plants got kind of confused by the weather this year. And they just, some of them came out and produced some nectar real late, but it wasn't very much nectar. I mean, it was just an odd year because of the weather more than anything else. And that's normally what impacts the honey flow, or honey year anyway, is the weather. You have to have enough water to get things done. You have to have heat. Heat drives nectar. If you don't have some nice warm temperature, you're not going to get much nectar coming up in the plants. So although I hate 100 degrees, if you're producing honey, that's the temperature you want. Yes? The question is when they blend honey, how much of the non-labeled variety can you add and still call it the labeled variety? And the answer is as much as you wish, as long as the predominant floral source, which means the flavor, is still what's on the label. So I can't give you the specific amount. I'm just saying that's how you do it. As soon as you change the flavor, then you can't label it what you had it labeled before. I kind of got most of that, but not all of it.
Where can you get the star thistle honey?
Where can you get it?
Yes.
If you want to get star thistle honey now, since it's never really been on the shelf anyway, I think, you still might be able to get it if they've got some and it really is what they claim it is at the more local outlets. So if you live around here, the Sacramento Beekeeping Supply over on 21st and X, they may have some, and they tend to buy it in kind of bulk containers, and you bring in your own container and fill it up and pay them. They may have it, okay? They had safflower, which I wanted you to taste because safflower is just as dark, basically, as buckwheat, but it doesn't taste anywhere near the same. It's much, much milder in taste, so you can't always figure that the dark honeys are going to be stronger in flavor. And avocado honey also is very, very dark, but when you eat it, it tastes like a milder honey. But you'll have to try the local people. You're not going to find it on the shelf.
How do you deal with the issue of toxic plants like oleander and Lathus sativus?
Okay.
Yeah.
The question is, how do we deal with plants that might have some kind of a toxic problem to them? You mentioned oleander. Honeybees will not normally forage from oleander. That's just all there is to it. They don't. Even though it's along the roads here and everything else, they always prioritize what's out there and take the one that they like best. Well, that's always at the bottom of the list. And generally, when they get about that far in the list, they quit. So that's not a problem. We have some places where there's rhododendrons, azaleas, and some of that kind of stuff, you know, naturally occurring. And we've never had any problem in this country except in the southeast and a few places where there's forests up there. Where you could actually get into trouble. But over in Europe, in some of those places, like you told us about past history, it still happens.
About mountain laurel back east of the Appalachians?
They've never blamed it. Bees do go to it. Because we had a specimen plant in our backyard in Massachusetts, and the bees went to it. But, you know, I haven't heard too much of that sort of thing. And another one you might be interested in is you happen to be in the right place where there's a bunch of poison oak growing. Honeybees just love poison oak, and they'll get in there. That's a very nice honey, very mild, nice-tasting honey, and it does not bring any of the oils along that cause the reactions. So you won't get itchy tongues from eating it. Yes?
Speaking of oils in the honey, is it
Lavender
oil that stored honey in plastic containers?
The question is it a good idea to store honey in plastic containers? If they have plastic containers that were specifically formulated for food, it should be fine. Honey is acid. Honey will react with some metals. Honey will eat your floor, your cement floor, out of your garage or out of your warehouse or whatever if you don't keep it cleaned up. It's that acidic. I mean, it's a mild acid, but it does that sort of thing. If you put honey, we don't do this much anymore because everything went over to plastic, but there was a time when honey was stored in tins. They were called tins. They held, I believe it was 5 gallons, which is 60 pounds. And if the tin was new and clean, you were in business. If the tin wasn't and it was kind of rusty, then some of that rust got incorporated into the honey. You couldn't taste it. There wasn't that much rust. But when you mixed that honey into a cup of tea, the iron and the tannin got together and made ink in your teacup. Yes? If we back up in history, well, the question is, what about the Chinese honey? If we back up in history just a little bit, until the 1980s, there was a government subsidy program the federal government would loan you money as a beekeeper on your honey crop so that you had something to spend and some way to pay your bills and whatnot until you could get your honey sold. And there was a formula that they figured how much the honey was worth, and the price of honey was just going way up there on that formula. So the beekeepers would take the loan, and then the government would say, okay, now, you got to pay that loan back with interest. When are you going to pay it? And the beekeeper would just smile and say, take the honey. So that's what happened. And the government became a clearinghouse. The government became the world's largest purchaser of honey. Okay? You knew that wasn't going to last, but that's how it got started. So they had to put it into food lunch programs, into institutional food programs. They had put it in giveaway programs. This was really high-class honey. That left a gaping hole. And I've already told you that we could only produce about half of what we consume here anyway. Well, most of that was going into the federal government. So we had to import almost all the honey that we were consuming in this country. So I had to come from somewhere. And that was about the time that the Chinese decided, you know what? We could get some of our lower income people out there into better income situation if we expanded beekeeping. So they expanded beekeeping like crazy over there. And they started producing honey like crazy. Okay? And then they started shipping it over here, because at that time the federal government was buying all the honey. So that's how we got into a situation where we started using an awful lot of Chinese honey. Well, then the subsidy program shut down and the beekeepers squawked, because that honey was coming in at about 32 cents a pound. And the beekeepers were used to getting between 50 and 75 cents a pound. And they said, this is no good. None of the people out there that are using honey are buying our honey. They're still buying all that Chinese honey. I won't get into whose fault that was, but that's what was going on. So then the question was, is there some way we can stop the Chinese honey from coming into the U.S.? Well, that's a nasty sort of thing to do. What are you going to do? Put tariffs on it, put prohibitions on it, all this kind of stuff. Well, anyway, the Chinese honey was coming in, and it went into the laboratories occasionally to be checked. And one time, they found out that there was an antibiotic in Chinese honey that we are not allowed to use in any of our food or get into any of our food, or we're not allowed to use it whatsoever in a food in the United States, and therefore all that honey could not be brought in. So that kind of slammed the door down for a while. Then we got into what he's asking about back there, which is, what about this? What about these weird honeys that come from China? One of the things that they thought they could do was take that honey and put water in it, thin it out, and run it through a process where they could tie up the chlorpheniclone, get it out of there, and then take the moisture out and condense it back, and then sell that to us as honey. Now that sounds like it would cost an arm and a leg, but they could still get it over here for 45, 42 cents a pound, even when that was done to it. So then we had to get to be better chemists to figure out what was coming in. The maltodextrin that you heard talked about today, that's used now to thin out honey, because it's cheap, and you can put it in honey, and therefore you can add expensive honey, cheap stuff, put them together, and then sell a whole blend. It's cheaper. We have that problem. And the chemists are having a difficult time taking rice sugar, as it's called, and finding that in the honey. So there's always this problem with shenanigans going on in the honey. Okay, so the federal government finally said, okay, we're going to put a tariff on the Chinese honey. It can come in, as long as it's healthy, fit, feed, pure. It can come in, but we're going to charge this big sum so that the cost is going to be the same as what the beekeepers are getting from their honey in the United States. And that was working for a while. But then the shipments from China began to back off. In fact, they backed off a lot. But all of a sudden, there were shipments from Taiwan, there were shipments from India, there were shipments from all over the place where they don't have that many colonies in their countries to produce that much honey. So we started looking at them, and it was honey coming from somewhere else. You know, those are kind of tropical. When you get down into those warmer regions, those are sort of tropical countries. And like we saw today, tropical honeys are a little bit different. And yet this was nice, you know, temperate climate stuff, which means it was the Chinese honey coming in a different way. And that just keeps going on and going on and going on. And we fight this all the time, and we throw people in jail, and we fine people and all sorts of things up in Canada, in the United States, importers, all this sort of thing. And there's really no stopping it. And besides, we need honey coming in from somewhere. So you can get it from Argentina, you can get it from Brazil, you can get it from Canada, okay? Or you can get it from halfway around the world. So this will just be an ongoing little contest to see who can trick who. That's the way it normally works. One of the other tricks they had was they would bring it in and they'd say, okay, we're going to bring it in at 32 cents. And you write up, you know, how much we owe you, and then we'll pay you, but we got to get it distributed. So it comes in, it gets distributed. Then the we pay you part falls apart. Oh, you know, that company went bankrupt. Right. You only owe us millions of dollars, and suddenly you went bankrupt. That happened over and over again, too. But we're learning. We don't let them do that anymore. Cash up front, or it doesn't come in. But it's, you know, it's just one of those things where every time we get into trade negotiations with China, honey is, among other things, comes up. Shrimp had the same problem. Chlorpheniclone was found in shrimp. So this is an ongoing thing. Yes? Yeah, but Norm mentioned that today. Is there any way you can keep the honey from crystallizing? If the honey is of a sugar constitution, which is a little high in the glucose end normally, that creates granulation, it can happen very, very fast. And two of them that will go really fast are sunflower and cotton. And if you're not careful, if you're a commercial beekeeper and you've extracted those and you let them sit in a tank more than about a day, you're going to have a solid tank. That's how fast it goes. Okay? When I had this cotton honey, in fact, the jar that the cotton honey is in, I'll guarantee you, it's starting to harden up already because it thickens up that quickly. So as Norm said, well, there's two. It's a temperature sort of thing, you know. It's granules that are coming out of the solution. And if you freeze it, that kind of puts an end to it. The molecules can't move around very much, so the granules don't get a chance to grow. At the other end, if you hold it warmer and it actually, you know, keeps the molecules stirred up quite a bit, then they can't produce little granules either. But if you hold honey warm for very long, you've kind of wrecked it because it will get darker and it loses its flavor. So you don't really want to do that. So I mean, if you really want to hold it, freezing is about the only thing that you can do. The commercial guys get shelf life by taking the honey, heating up to a pasteurization temperature so they take the yeast out of it, most of the yeast out of it. Then they run it through some kind of a very fine filter. And then they take their jars, and just before the bottles go in, there's a jar flipper that goes over, and then the blasted air comes up and blows out all the dust particles, because they can be nuclei for those granulations too. It flips right side up, the honey goes in, the cap goes on. That gives you your longest shelf life, because you've basically heated it to the point that you've melted all the granules that were in it. And then you took out the pollen, you took out the dust, you took out anything that happened to be in there, you also took out the flavor. Okay, and then you end up with this long shelf life of nice, clear honey. Yes?
Does the color of the honey relate to how many phenols are in it?
Oh, okay. The question is, if you look at these honeys, and let's say that you look at the Tupelo and the Eastern Buckwheat, is it likely that they will have more of these polyphenols and antioxidants in it? And the answer is, in a general sense, yes. Those would be the, quote, more healthy of the honeys if you looked at them from that point of view. But it isn't a strict correlation, but it's more along those lines. Now, if you really want to get into a honeybee-produced product that's high in those plant sort of things, you can select what's called honeydew. And that's produced by honeybees that are in a somewhat forested area. And there are these little insects, mostly scale insects, that suck on the trees. And when these scale insects are sucking on the trees, they're looking for protein. Well, there isn't very much protein coming through the sap of a plant. So they have to run an awful lot of sap through their bodies to get that little bit of protein. Well, they don't take out much sugar, so when it comes out the other end, you've got kind of a sappy sugar solution there. And in some cases, the bees will really get into that. But you saw Liz today mention those long chain carbohydrates. Okay, this stuff that we call honeydew, that sap that's coming out being collected by the bees, has a lot of those long chain things in it. Bees can't digest those. They don't do very well getting much past a disaccharide, sucrose, or the glucose and the fructose. They can't, anything longer than that, they're kind of out of luck. Okay. If you can't digest it, what happens? Well, it kind of just sits in the intestinal tract until something happens. The something is microbes go after it. Okay? Once you get a big microbial development going on here, particularly yeasts, the bees have got a problem. So if they get into this stuff early enough, they can go out and defecate, which is what they're supposed to do. But if they get confined on that stuff over winter, then they have real problems with defecating in the hive and getting into all sorts of problems. So you try not to overwinter your bees on honeydew. If you want to sell it, extract it and send it to Germany, because that's what they call black forest honey, and they'll pay you a premium for it. It's sticky, it's gooey, it smells resinous, it sticks in your extractor. I mean, it's really different. It's called honeydew. I didn't see much of that on the market either, but I wasn't going to buy that and bring it here anyhow. Yes, sir.
Can you talk a little bit about the process of what bees do with the honey over the course of the season from, say, the spring to late fall, and how the honey changes and changes the flavor over the season?
Okay, the question was, What do bees do with their honey during the year? Does the flavor change over the season and whatnot? Let's do the second part first because it's easier. Generally speaking, once the honey is in the comb with the capping over it, the flavor is not really going to change very much from year to year. I mean, it will change, but it's not a big change. I mean, if you taste it 1 year, it's clover. If you taste it the next year, it's clover. If you taste it the next year, it's clover. Get a little bit darker, the flavor might not be quite as nice anymore, but you know, it's still clover honey, and they can still eat it, we can still eat it. So that part of it's not a problem. When excess nectar is coming in, the bees will evaporate the water out of it and store the sugar syrup, now thickened sugar syrup, as honey. They put it behind the cavity, and it'll basically stay there. There won't be any problems, unless, like, you can't store much cotton honey in a beehive, and you can understand why. And let me just mention one more thing about granulation. When the granulation is not controlled, you get all these little sugar things growing, and you may have made rock candy when you were kids in a jar of water. You let the water evaporate and get rock candy, okay. If too much sugar comes out as granules, what does it leave behind? Wetter water, right? A higher moisture content. There's loose water in there now because the granules got together. Okay, the yeasts are still in there, the yeast spores. And as soon as the moisture content gets to the part where they can ferment it, they'll germinate, come out, and start fermenting your honey. So that what you're likely to run into is granulation, sometimes followed by fermentation. And you'll know that because little bubbles come up. When you take the top off, it smells a little alcoholic. And you just made a sort of a like little blended mead there in the top of your jar. So that's something you have to watch out for. And then that's basically it. That's about the only thing that goes wrong with honey is it ferments. It generally doesn't go any further than that. Unless the top is open somewhere, and then after you've got alcohol in there, you can get bacteria in there, and they start making organic acids, and then it goes very sour, and then becomes poisonous to bees. That's not going to happen in your honey very often. That happens in your sugar feed that you left where you shouldn't have. Yes?
About the shelf life, you talked about getting granules in it, but if you don't, if you just have it in a closed jar, how long is honey good for? I mean, is there really a shelf life?
Okay, the question is, if you don't mind the granulation, and you just sat here granulated for a long time, and you wanted to microwave it, melt it back up again, would it be okay? And just like saying the same thing, it'll get darker, and the flavor won't be as good. But yes, it's still honey. Now, somebody was talking earlier about they found some fluids or whatever in the Egyptian mummy moon, whatever. No, that stuff, if somebody tells you can eat that, forget it. Honey doesn't last forever, I'm sorry. But it does last a long time. Yeah. Yes?
Does he eat the honey? At what temperature does he eat the honey? Destroy the enzymes? Does it destroy all the enzymes?
Okay, the question is, at what temperature does he eat the honey destroy enzymes? That's going to depend upon to whom you speak. Because the people that believe that honey should never be eaten at all, zero, forget it. Okay? We tell you it should never even reach a temperature of 90 degrees. The truth of the matter is most enzymes are broken down at about the same temperature that you and I can't stand to put our hands in there anymore, which is about 110 to 120. That's about it. 120 is scalding. 110 hertz. Okay, right around then you are losing quite a few enzymes. They're not going anywhere, but their configuration making their enzymes get contorted, then they can't act as enzymes anymore. Okay, now, the interesting thing is that the Germans check for diastase, which is an enzyme in the honey, to prove it hasn't been heated. Well, first of all, diastase breaks down starch. Have people told you that bees can't tolerate starch? That's not true. So don't worry if you want to feed a powdered sugar that there's a little starch in here to keep it from the sugar from thickening, okay? So they look for diastase. They will not accept many of the honeys from California because they claim that we heated them. We didn't heat them. We let them sit in the field where the field temperature got to 120. We've got those temperatures. And the box itself got even warmer. Now the bees will do their best to keep that temperature down, but they're not trying to protect diastase, I'll tell you. So our honey gets heated in the field and we can't pass the German tests because they claim that we overheated our honey. Okay? There's nothing wrong with that honey, from my point of view.